Thanks everyone for sticking around. I'm the last speaker in this symposium. I appreciate you being here. I also want to acknowledge my co-authors, Dr. Lynn Sullenberger and Joe Vendramini. They've been collaborating with my carbon-related project. So we took a tour. Now we're going to go from Kentucky back to Florida. We're here in Florida again. If you are a student or if you've never been in Florida, I encourage you to go outside and take a look at our soils. We are very unique. I'm a soil scientist by training, and I've never been exposed to a soil like the ones we have in Florida. If you haven't heard or haven't seen, we have extremely sand soils. And by extremely sand, before I came to Florida, I thought, well, maybe 15% sandy, that's sandy, but clay, I'm sorry. But the soils here contain 98, 99% sand. So some of the issues that we're dealing here are completely different than the rest of the world because of the characteristics of our soils. So I understand that I might be preaching to the choir here, but I want to very briefly mention, provide an overview why carbon sequestration is important, and why particularly in grazing lands. And I'm not going to talk about the benefits associated with carbon sequestration in the soil. I think everybody knows what there are multiple benefits. But I want to talk why specifically we're talking about grazing lands. So if we look at a global scale, grazing lands are important, is an important land use. In the U.S., we have about 238 million hectares of grazing lands. And most of the grazing lands in the United States are rangelands, and they're primarily located in the western part of the country. Most of my talk, most of the data that I'm going to refer to during my presentation are the pasture lands, which represent a smaller proportion of the grazing lands in the United States. And they're mainly located in the eastern side of the country. So it's a very important land use. Any small changes that we make in terms of how we manage carbon in these soils can have tremendous impact on the overall global cycle. Another very interesting characteristic, the grazing land area in the United States as a whole is decreasing over time. So there's multiple reasons for that, and a lot of the grazing lands have been replaced by other land uses, primarily urban development. But interestingly, in the southeastern United States, we're actually increasing our grazing land area. And this is the most recent stat that I found, was published in 2012 by USDA. And there's about a 25% increase in the grazing land area in the southeastern United States, which was very surprising to me. In states like Florida, we have the largest influx of people, and our grazing land area continues to expand. So this is remarkable, I think. And there are multiple reasons why that's happening. But so the other very unique aspect about grazing lands and why soil carbon is particularly important is the fact that, let's say, compared to a tropical forest, where most of the carbon is associated with above-ground biomass, in grazing lands, most of the carbon is below ground. More specifically, it's in the soil. So when we look at the partition of carbon in the different ecosystem compartments, about 90% of the carbon is in the soil. So if you were to increase carbon in the ecosystem, we have to look at more carefully what's going on in the soil. And this might be a biased statement because I'm a soil scientist, but the literature reflects that. I'm using something very similar to what some of the previous speakers, Randy, presented, what I assume to be a very simplistic approach to understand soil carbon sequestration. So you have carbon inputs in a grazing land situation, and you have carbon inputs. And what we measure in the soil, hopefully, is that net balance between the carbon inputs and carbon outputs. And in a very simplistic manner, we tend to think that, well, if I implement a management practice that increase the carbon inputs and reduce the inputs, that would automatically result in an increase in carbon sequestration. If everything was as easy as I said, I think we would be in a much better situation. But the processes that occur in the soil are a little bit more complicated. So even in a hypothetical ideal scenario, the soil has a limited amount of carbon that can be sequestered. And that amount is influenced by several factors. For instance, climate. Carbon sequestration is positively correlated with precipitation. The higher the precipitation, the greater the carbon sequestration rates. However, it's inversely correlated with temperature. Higher temperature, lower the sequestration. Landscape position is another aspect that influences the amount of carbon that's accumulated in the soil. And I want to spend a little bit more time talking about the soil type component. So if we were to expect that in soils like the what I just mentioned about Florida soils, we're never going to get the same soil carbon sequestration rates as compared to other systems because our unique situation, our unique soil types. So this is a map of the predominant soil orders in the United States. And if we look at most of my work has been done in the southeastern United States. Where's my pointer? Okay. If we look in this map, the orange representing this graphic here is our altisols. So the three predominant soil orders in the southeastern United States are altisols. And if you look in Florida, the pink, light pink color, I don't know if you can see really well the color, but those are spodosols. So we have a lot of spodosols in Florida. And the blue color is entisols. What are the major constraints associated with these soil types? Well, first of all, they're in the old terms that we used to define what is soil fertility, these are very low fertility soils. They're very acidic. They have very limited nutrient concentration. So what it means that they require additional inputs in order for these soils to be productive, produce biomass, and increase carbon inputs. So we're talking about liming, fertilization. But more specifically, relative to carbon, one common characteristic of these soils is that they have a very coarse texture. So when we think in terms of those balanced carbon inputs and carbon outputs, the amount of carbon that's the outputs that are released back to the atmosphere can be quite high. So we are in the southeastern United States, the temperature and the climatic conditions are very conducive to producing high biomass. However, we also have extremely high decomposition rates. So those arrows, like Randy mentioned, sometimes they can be very similar. So that becomes a challenge if we're thinking in terms of at least maintaining carbon levels. It's a very difficult process. So what are other limitations associated with even maintaining carbon in our soils? I mentioned the soil types, but I think one of the most, from the practical standpoint, is the lack of incentives. So unless if that particular management practice is going to result in increasing productivity, most likely that's not going to be adopted. So even if we tell producers that by managing their pasture in a certain way, it's going to increase carbon sequestration, unless that also translates into productivity, most likely that practice is not going to be accepted. And the other challenge is that as we look into the future, the climate change scenarios, we're expecting to increase our temperatures by an average of 1.5 and 2 degrees centigrade. And I mentioned that carbon sequestration is inversely correlated with carbon sequestration. So if we don't do anything, if you continue to manage our pastures same way we're currently doing, carbon stocks are supposed to expect that you go down just because of the temperature increases. And also, some of the management practices that are being perceived as alternatives to increase soil carbon sequestration can also have some unintended environmental consequences. And we're going to talk into more details, but for instance, one that comes to my mind is nitrogen fertilization. Yes, nitrogen fertilization can promote net primary productivity, but it can also have a whole range of unintended consequences. In Florida, water quality is a major issue. Nitrous oxide, other greenhouse gas emissions can also be promoted. So we have to take a more holistic approach when we look into these management practices that can promote carbon, because they can have other negative impacts on the environment. And I think both speakers mentioned this, the time and the scale. Carbon sequestration is a very difficult process to measure. It's a long-term process. We're lucky in the southeastern United States that we can measure things to happen a little bit faster. But as a whole, soil carbon sequestration is a very, very slow process. And there's a lot of limitations associated with accurately measuring soil carbon sequestration. There's a lot of spatial variability, temporal variability. So it's very difficult to measure. And sometimes the treatments that we're establishing only going to have very modest increases in soil carbon. And we consider that we have all this variability associated with soil carbon. It's very hard to accurately quantify those small changes. So, but I'm a very positive person. Regarding all these limitations, I think there's still opportunities to increase soil carbon. Most of the literature indicates that anything that we do, and some of the speakers kind of alluded to that, anything that we do to increase biomass production, net primary productivity, can indirectly positively impact soil carbon. Not only that, but it can also have some co-benefits associated with ecosystem resilience. And I know we're short in time, but I just want to mention something very quickly. I have an extension, extension responsibility in my position here at the University of Florida. And one month, I wrote an article about the importance of carbon sequestration in grazing lands in a producer's magazine. I was not expecting a whole lot of feedbacks, because this is not, soil carbon is not something that producers can automatically relate to their production system and how that can impact their, especially the economics of their operation. But I got a lot of feedbacks, and one producer took a picture of the pasture that he perceived as having more soil organic matter compared to another one, and how that pasture that had higher organic matter was performing better in a drought condition. So yes, this is a producer's perception, but it's also the scientific literature has shown that by increasing carbon, you can increase the resilience of grazing land ecosystems. And as I mentioned, because of the large area involved, even in small increases, in either they're positive or negative, can have huge impact on the global overall global carbon cycles. Some of the work done by Dr. Ron Follett from Fort Collins, Colorado, he indicated that if we change 1% of the soil carbon stocks in grazing lands in the United States, either positive or negative, that 1% will be the equivalent of the entire greenhouse gas emissions by U.S. agriculture. So it's a tremendous change in the overall global cycle. Now we're going to talk a little bit more specifically what are the management practices that can contribute to increasing soil carbon. And I'm arbitrarily categorizing this management practice as extensive and intensive. And by extensive, what I mean is very minimal or no infrastructure or additional inputs required. And the intensive, of course, will be the ones that require, involve more cost. And I also want to mention that this is, my presentation is not intended to be a very comprehensive literature review, so I just selected some papers that were related to my talk. So if you work in this area and I'm not using your paper, please don't feel like you're not important. But the intention was just to mention a couple papers. Students don't use this as part of your literature review because there's much more important information in the literature that I'm not going to be mentioning today. Randy mentioned Rich Conan's recent paper. I'm still using his old reference that was published in 2001. If you work with grazing lands and carbon, I think you probably came across this paper before. If not, highly encourage you to read. So it's a meta-analysis similar to the most recent paper that this group published. And so they evaluated the impact of what they are calling improved management practices on soil carbon responses, and includes about 115 studies. And out of this 115, about 70% of the studies reported an increase in soil carbon after the adoption of these improved management practices. Okay, well, it can improve, but when you look at more carefully the range that those responses occur, on average, the increase in soil carbon sequestration was about 31%, but the range was very wide, from 4 to 76%. So what it tells us is that the same management practice can have completely different impacts depending on a number of factors, the soil type, where the location where the management practice was implemented. So we need to take very careful, very local approach when we look at these management practices. But the bottom line of this publication was that more carbon inputs is the main control on soil carbon. I mentioned that some of the processes that control carbon accumulation in the soil are dictated by some of the soil characteristics. So there's not much we can do in terms of reducing the carbon outputs. But there's a lot we can do to increase the carbon inputs. And that's basically what this literature review indicated. So what are these management practices that can increase carbon sequestration? First one, I mentioned briefly fertilization. Fertilization can improve above and below ground net primary productivity, can change the species composition, can change the quantity and the quality of the carbon that's returned to the soil. But also, if we think in terms of nitrogen fertilization, there's a lot of negative potential consequences associated with nitrogen fertilization. Greenhouse gases, water quality, And also, when we think in terms of of fertilization on grazing lands, it's not just nitrogen. So I'm not going to show data, but I think this picture really tells a lot of important information. So what I'm showing, this paper has been recently published at Crop Science, and what you are looking at are Jigs Bermuda grass pastures without potassium and with potassium. So you can see, and these are relatively short-term study, three-year study, that we impose these different fertility treatments. So it's not just, fertilization is not all about nitrogen. It's a more comprehensive approach. In this case, this particular species is very sensitive to potassium deficiency. So yes, fertilization can improve the above ground biomass. This study, we're not focused on carbon, but it gives you an example how fertilization can have tremendous impact on the carbon inputs, carbon that is returning back to the soil. So this study, it was a long-term study, Alan Franz-Luber and his collaborators in Georgia, they did on tall fescue. Long-term study, 20 years, under different fertilization regimes, and they are calling low and high fertilization regime. And I want to reiterate, it's a 20-year study. And when you look at the carbon sequestration or carbon stocks associated with these different treatments, the low fertilization compared to the high fertilization, yes, there was an increase. But if you look at the extent that the increase occurred, it was very minimal, 7% increase in the soil carbon sequestration over a period of 20 years. So if you are a student working on your PhD thesis for 3 years, most likely, don't want to ruin your life, but most likely you're not going to be able to see those differences. You have to wait a little bit longer to be able to detect changes in soil carbon. However, there's some fractions that can change much faster. You don't have to wait 20 years. In this particular study, Alan didn't, well, he observed an increase in particular organic carbon, which is the indicator of lay biocarbon. Yes, an increase in response to the higher fertilization level. But if you look at the proportion of POM relative to total carbon, it's about the same. I think if I calculated correctly, this is about 20-25%. So the proportion in either of the two treatments was about 20% of the total carbon was associated with a particular organic carbon. The reason why I want to stress that, because sometimes we increase soil carbon. We increase the soil carbon stocks, but the increase occurs primarily in fractions that are more readily available, which can be a problem. If we introduce a disturbance after that increase, the system can revert back to the initial conditions. So all the carbon that was accumulated over the years can very easily go back to the initial situation, can very easily be minimized. Here's another study conducted in Kansas. This is a much shorter term study, 5 years instead of the 20 years that I just presented. And all I want you to focus your attention are in these two treatments, the fertilized versus unfertilized. This is a fertilized versus unfertilized. And by the way, these are C3-dominated ecosystems. So yeah, in the course of 5 years, these authors observed a much greater increase in soil organic carbon, 13.5% increase in the soil carbon. But like I said, in this particular set, I'm not showing the data here, but most of that increases were associated with lay biocarbon fractions. So the reason why I use these two papers is just to show the contrasting results. 1 to 20 years to increase only 7%. In this other study, in a tempered environment, in 5 years, he observed almost twice as much as the carbon sequestration rate. So there's a lot of reasons why that happened. Nitrogen can also, I said, can promote microbial activity and at least in the short term, increase carbon mineralization. That's called priming effect. And this study was conducted in Ecuador with C4 warm season grasses. And let's look at just the top 5 centimeters. What the authors did, they compared microbial respiration in soils that were unfertilized with soils that received 150 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare. So the microbial respiration was greater in that in the fertilized treatments. And by difference, they calculate the priming effect. And they did that over time, 1 day after the fertilization, up to 28 days after the fertilization. The bottom line is right after we apply nitrogen, if the ecosystem is nitrogen limited, that nitrogen, that additional nitrogen is going to promote microbial activity. But that priming effect tended to disappear with time. However, there's important changes in the microbial community, like the previous speaker was talking about, in response to some of these management practices. for instance, this is very often reported in the literature. Nitrogen can stimulate, can increase the abundance of fungi and certain type of bacteria. So this is something that will indirectly affect the carbon soil, the carbon in the soil. Another management practice that's been often suggested to increase soil carbon sequestration is the introduction or reintroduction of grasses and legumes. And I'm going to mention one of the studies that my group was involved. We're looking at the conversion of native rangeland. This is a Florida native rangeland. It's a C3-dominated ecosystem into a C4-dominated system, with the silvopasture here being intermediate. So we look at the carbon responses, and this is a long-term study, 25 years. Yes, the conversion increased carbon sequestration. However, like I said, most of the carbon that was accumulated in the improved pasture was associated with labile fractions. So anything that we do mismanages pasture, it can be very, very easily, carbon can be very easily lost back to the atmosphere. Introduction of legumes, there's tons of paper in the literature that indicates positive, neutral. I never came across one that shows negative impact on carbon sequestration. But this is a group that I was working with in Australia. They overseeded leucaena in warm season grass pastures. And I want to take home message of this particular slide. Just, I want to show again the very modest increases in soil carbon. This is a 40-year study, and the annual sequestration rates were very small, very difficult to measure if this was a short-term study. I'm also almost finishing my presentation. Grazing management, and by grazing management, what I mean is grazing intensity, stocking rate, methods of grazing. This is probably one of the most controversial topics in the literature. And I think the reason why that happened is you're going to find the same number of papers that show positive responses compared to negative responses. And I think this is partially due to the fact that grazing is very poorly described. So the intensity and duration that the grazing occur, sometimes it's not very well described. And when we interpret those data, it can be very challenging. This is a study, again, in mixed rangelands, C3-dominated species, where the authors compared treatments that were not allowed, grazing was excluded, compared to light grazing, which meaning less than the recommended NRCS, and heavy grazed, continuously heavy grazed. I want you to take a look at this 0 to 60 centimeter depth. So yeah, the light grazing increased carbon stocks relative to the control. However, when we increase the stocking rate, that didn't seem to be the case. So there was no statistical difference between heavy grazed and the treatments that were excluded from grazing. But not only that, if you look at the very average, even though the statistically this average is not different than the excluded, numerically is much smaller. So I suspect that over time, the overgrazing is going to reduce carbon stocks compared to the system that were grazing was excluded. My very last slide, 2-year study. So we were comparing 21-year study with a 2-year study in Florida where things happen much faster. We can change in both carbon in both directions. This is a 2-year study. We were evaluating different stocking rates of in Chifton 85. So the stubble height, the greater stubble height, the smaller the stubble height, the greater the stocking rate. So eight centimeters stubble height, meaning more animals per unit of area. 2-year study, we didn't expect changes in total carbon as we observed. However, the more labile carbon, in this case, we are represented by particular organic carbon, was linearly decreased in the heavy, in the more intensively grazed pasture. And there were many reasons for that. There was changes in the amount of carbon that were added to the system, but also the chemical characteristics of the carbon inputs were affected by the stubble height. So my final remarks, yes, there's opportunities. The opportunities exist where we can increase productivity. There's also co-benefits associated with that. It's particularly in poor soils like we have. Anything that we have to at least maintain our soil organic levels because they have a multitude of functions in our soils. However, the direction and magnitude that a particular management practice will impact soil carbon will have to be analyzed in a more local scale, because there are a number of factors that can affect the responses, and the greatest likelihood of observing a potential increase in carbon stocks in response to this management are in degraded soil. So a lot of our pastures are degraded. That's the situation where our likelihood will be greater, likelihood of observing increases in soil carbon will be greater. I mentioned that some of these management practices can have, if we're only solely focusing on soil carbon and forgetting about all the other ecosystem services associated with grazing lands, we might think that this particular management practices looks good, but however, it can have some other potentially negative impact on the environment. And finally, the importance of baseline measurements. Before, it's very important for us to accurately measure what we have to begin with before we implement a management practice, so we are able to more accurately determine what are the improvements or if there's any carbon losses. With that, I'll end here, and I appreciate your attention. I'll be happy to take any questions.
Any questions for Maria?
By the way, this is a Florida soil, the Mayaca series. Very pretty soil profile. I'm going to repeat the question. I'm not sure if everybody heard. When we observe differences in increases in carbon sequestration in response to nitrogen fertilization, the question was whether a life cycle analysis was performed. In other words, the energy that was spent in the production of the fertilizer was taken into consideration. In that particular study, no. There are some other students in Dr. Sonnenberger's group that are doing something similar, comparing pastures that are fertilized with nitrogen and overseeded with versus overseeded with legumes, and seeing the impacts. It is very, very hard for nitrogen to be neutral. If you use a life cycle assessment, it's very unlikely that nitrogen fertilization will have a neutral balance. Usually, we're going to be in the negative side. It's not something that can be easily offset. The negative impact cannot be easily offset. But it can very easily increase. That was one of my remarks. If we're only looking at carbon, yes, it looks like there's a positive impact. But if we look at the overall system, that might not be the same conclusion.
Any